So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Man here with The Modern Man. And hello to Julian, who says, Ollie, I've been a listener since episode one and love the many varied, fascinating life stories you've covered since I first bought you a beer in December 2015. Thank you for that, Julian, both the praise and the money. I welcome both with open arms. I wanted to pass on an idea for a possible life story, continues Julian, having read an article by James Bloodworth about his experiences working in an Amazon warehouse. I'd heard bits and pieces about the supposed conditions inside these warehouses, but in this excerpt from his book, he really brought the harsh reality to life. I'm sure, like many, I've taken Amazon's growth to the internet giant that it has become pretty much for granted, and I've purchased loads through them. However, James has really made me think seriously about whether I should boycott Amazon for now, and I think he'd be a great guest on your show. Well, Julian, through the magic of podcasting and the glory of us being a listener-supported independent show, I'm very pleased to tell you today's middle feature is indeed an interview with James Bloodworth, as you suggested, and he does offer real insight into what life is like working at the bottom rung of the ladder for the world's largest multinational, boxing up books and DVDs that we do all take for granted. It's a really enlightening listen, so thank you very much. I think you'll enjoy it. Remember, if you have an idea for anyone whose experience you think deserves a wider audience, someone you think might inspire your fellow Man fans, don't hesitate to get in touch with us. There is a feedback form on our website, modernmanwith2ns.co.uk. I do read all your emails personally. I can't reply to them all, but we do take your suggestions seriously. Many of them end up on the show. We really appreciate it. Right, this week you will learn why you should bring a friend with you when you go to an art gallery. You'll learn how much it costs per second to advertise on the giant billboard at Piccadilly Circus, and you'll learn which parasitic insect is desperate to live in your beard. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
It was like an airport with airport-style queues as well, waiting to go through security, so that could be half your break gone by the time you reach the canteen.
Demeaning, poorly paid and tedious. Life in Amazon's warehouse.
A little bit of cross-stitch and then mould a dildo.
And Alex Fox gets crafty on the hunt for a silent vibrator. But first, it's time for the Zeitgeist, all the trends you need to know about for the week ahead, with Ollie Peart, the man who told me he has, in the last 5 days, eaten 15 veggie burgers, and I'm tempted to imagine that's an over-exaggeration.
Since going vegetarian, I've been trying to find the perfect veggie burger, and I'm struggling. I genuinely can't find it. So every time I go to a restaurant, and I see there's a veggie burger on the menu, I order it.
What would you like to kick us off with?
Memory.
Of the computerised or humankind?
Both.
Okay.
So you're on holiday, like maybe at Pisa, or Machu Picchu. Possibly.
Bognor,
why not? And the first thing you do is you think, oh, I want to remember this. This is beautiful. I'm loving it. I'm enjoying this situation. So you whip your phone out and you snap away. Snap, 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 snap.
You're describing photography.
And what you're actually doing is you're externalising your memory, Ollie.
You're outsourcing what you'd normally keep in your brain.
Exactly.
Okay.
The trouble is that our memories are very easily corrupted. There was a study that was done by a psychologist called Elizabeth Loftus. She found that when she told people that cars collided instead of hit, they remembered that accident or that moment as far more serious than it actually was. And technology, your phone, is literally changing how we remember things, because our attention is completely diverted away from the experience that's around us. So like 15 years ago, if you wanted to, if you were on your holiday or whatever, you'd whip out your camera and you might take the odd snap, but that's it. When you're in that moment, your brain is absorbing all that information. It's taking it all in. You're far more likely to remember it. You remember the sounds, the sensations, and whatever else is going on.
Because you spent more time looking at it than looking at a screen looking at it.
Exactly.
But when you say that taking a multitude of photos and storing them on your phone is somehow less accurate than your own brain memories, the opposite is true, isn't it? You actually have an accurate document, if you haven't put a photo filter on it, of what it actually looked like. And before, when you used to just have one, okay, you might take 36 pictures, but only one of them would be good enough, your whole memory of that holiday was influenced by just one picture of your mum standing with a lion. And that's not what the whole holiday was like. There was the boring journey in the car to get there and all the rest of it.
First of all, I want to see that picture. Second of all, the problem is that you're talking about one sense. You're talking about the visual sense. And when you're on holiday or you're wherever it might be, remember this one example, which I will use. In Greece, and I was sat having dinner. I was right by the water, and there was amazing sounds. The smells were incredible. The taste of the food was incredible. The wine was amazing. The chat was good. A photo would do very little justice of that. It would just be a very noisy, slightly crap photo because it was quite dark.
Yeah, whereas a mobile phone video gives you quite a lot of sensation, doesn't it?
Well, there was another study. What it did is it took people on a self-guided tour around a church, and half of them had a camera and half of them didn't. And then a week later, they were asked a questionnaire about their tour and how much they remembered. Those without the camera scored 7 out of 10, 70%, and those with the camera scored 6 out of 10, 60%. So that's a 10% difference. If your memory, I know it's only little, but if your memory dropped by 10%, do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but I bet they hadn't looked at the photos they took as an aid memoir. That's my point. Like, yes, you're right, that if you are looking at the experience through a lens rather than in real life, as it were, then at the time you're going to have a better brain memory formed by looking at it. But I think retrospectively, looking back over your series of photos or videos, it can be an amazing way to remember what it was like in a way that wasn't possible before.
Yeah, but gut instincts are created by experience, and if we, you know, outsource our experiences, that's going to be a problem, isn't it? It's not as if you're going to go back through your photos every time you want to make a decision, is it?
What else have you got for us this week?
What do Nicolas Cage in Con Air, John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, Ewan McGregor in Star Wars, Attack of the Clones, Bono and David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust have in common? The mullet!
Oh, right, yeah.
It's back.
No, it isn't. I mean, I wish it was, because I haven't had my hair cut recently, and I'd like to have an excuse.
The hairdresser, John Vile, he's based in Sloane Square.
Uh-huh.
He's got a pop-up somewhere else. And he has reinvented the mullet for the 21st century.
How?
Well, he started by giving the mullet to women, which is a bit of a change, isn't it? It was typically a male haircut.
Yeah, now that I have seen, actually, on catwalks and stuff, women with mullets.
There you go.
But again, you see a lot of things on catwalks that never materialise in real life.
See, I thought that as well. So I thought I'd email John.
You've emailed the man at the source of the trend?
Yeah. And I thought...
You've done some research?
Well, no, because he hasn't got back to me yet.
Right, okay.
I've only made sort of like the first point
fine.
Of contact.
Okay, yeah.
But I thought, if he's prepared to cut my hair in a mullet, I will see if, as he says, if it really is a high-maintenance haircut that is experimental and not for everyone.
I love that by doing this show you've begun to challenge yourself as well as rely on our listeners to challenge you.
Well, because I just...
I feel like in a way this show's about you growing as a person as much as it is about encouraging our listeners to try new trends.
I feel like I am too.
Should we bring on the results of your actual challenge? Last week, ManFan Alan tasked you with trying to get your face somewhere impressive for £100. How have you fared?
Well, impressive to me in advertising would be... I actually thought the moon at first, so I thought, can I get my face lasered on the moon?
Right.
I couldn't find anyone that could do that. And
Such
also thought it might be...
a unique individual.
Yeah, but I thought that'd
it's
be...
extraordinary.
I thought that'd
think.
Be illegal as well.
Yeah.
Probably, isn't it? Like, because you know, like, they laser pen, like, pilots and stuff.
Fine, anyway, what was your second thought?
Piccadilly Circus. The big screen's here.
Yes.
They've been here for over 100 years. Coca-Cola's been here since 1955.
Yeah, I think you can guess from the level of the sponsors, Samsung, Coca-Cola, the BBC, that you probably can't afford that for £100.
Well, no, I can't. It costs 95 pence a second to advertise on that board. So,
oh. But
they're not going to give me a second.
No, but...
And I couldn't actually
get hold
of...
But you've got more than 95 pence. You've got £100 to spend.
Yeah.
So just be clear.
Yeah.
So my math is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
How much could you buy for £100 on the Piccadilly Circus billboards in London's West End?
Just over a minute.
Yeah, minute and a half.
Yeah.
That's actually quite good, because, you know, for a publicity stunt or whatever, all you'd need is a picture of you standing in front of it.
Hmm.
It'd be worth £100, wouldn't
but
it?
But that's based on the annual cost. So the annual cost is £30 million a year.
Ah, yeah,
right?
So that's a bit out of our budget.
If I said to them, oh, look, I want a second.
Yeah.
Or 100 seconds. Well, 100 they'll probably seconds. Go, well, we'll probably.
Minute and a half,
we're going to charge you
£100
a second. They'd do something like that,
yeah.
wouldn't they?
I guess by the time the lawyers are involved and you've got to sign contracts for your minute and a half, that wouldn't be worth it.
So then I thought traditional billboards, that'd be quite a good idea, wouldn't it? And they come in like they come in two forms. There's a 48-sheet billboard and there's a 96-sheet. 48-sheet, between £150 and £250. So I can't get
yeah,
one
yeah,
of
but
those.
You've got to print off the sheets.
Got to print off the sheets.
Got to find, where are you going to find sheets?
Exactly.
I don't have a sheet supplier.
The next stop was, well, why don't I go for print magazines?
Yes.
Yeah? So I thought Esquire magazine.
Yeah.
Esquire. Cover, full page, $156,000.
Yeah, so you're just a thousand.
Do you mean, yeah, what? $156,000
yeah, sure, yeah.
for a cover page of a magazine? Are
yes.
you mad?
No, I'm not. What?
That's not okay.
What? Well, it is if you're Yves Saint Laurent. It's obviously out of your price, but I'm saying it's not unexpected. I'd expect that. It's a fashion magazine.
It's, yes, okay.
I'm not going to have an argument with you about this.
Okay, it's fine. It's
Did you start looking at sensible options?
Yes.
Are you outside the puppet theatre in Yeovil?
I, Ollie, will be gracing a digital billboard.
Yeah.
In Slough. Do you want to see the billboard?
I guess I want to see a picture of a billboard in Slough, yes.
Yes, you definitely want
context,
to see the billboard.
Yes, sure, okay.
There it is.
Yeah, 120,000 cars on a daily basis.
120,000 cars.
Opposite one of the largest Tesco superstores in the UK.
Also, if you look very carefully, it's in a bit of a dumpy bit of Slough there, so it stands out.
For £100, how much do you get for a crap billboard in Slough opposite Tesco?
So I'm going to be on it. For 5 seconds every 5 minutes for 24 hours.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and they've done me a deal. It's Mass Media Advertising have done me a deal. They said, look, normally it's a lot more expensive. It'd be twice as much as that.
So you've actually booked this in, have you?
Yeah, it's booked, yeah.
Are you going to go and have a look at it when it's on?
When I find out exactly what day it's going on, yes.
I don't want the Photoshop version of this. I want the actual selfie of you in front of your billboard.
Yeah,
otherwise
sure.
It didn't happen.
Yeah, okay.
I now wonder, because originally the task that Alan set you with was to get your face somewhere impressive.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you've aced it, but you've put it on a digital billboard, and that's
pretty big.
It's okay.
£100, it's pretty good.
I now think that maybe we should be taking the opportunity to promote the podcast rather than just your face, or do you still prefer the idea that it's just your face with no context at all?
Well, I thought it should say "See you next Tuesday" on it. And I don't know if
does that contravene guidelines?
I'm not sure. No, yeah. Surely it doesn't.
No, it's a slogan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought, because the picture
that's
I've got
perfect.
Is me...
And people in Slough would enjoy that.
Yeah, of course they would.
Anyone enjoys a pun. It's the Tesco Shoppers of Slough.
Yeah. I go past you. He means cunt.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Well, maybe we can try and have a man day trip. I'll see if... let me know when it's going to be on the billboard and I'll try and come down with you.
I will.
And we'll keep an eye on our Twitter feed as well, at The Modern Man, when we know... we'll put it on Twitter, and maybe it would be great, wouldn't it, if we could have some man fans actually taking pictures themselves in front of the Piet Shrine.
Yeah, with me, possibly. I'll happily sign autographs.
Yeah. Excellent. It's like the most low-rent local radio thing ever, isn't it? Come and meet me in a car park opposite Tesco in Slough.
Yeah, oh, it's going to be amazing. It's a homecoming. I'm from just up the road.
Here's the digital envelope. Let's reveal your task for next week's show.
Alfie from Chicago says, I'd like Ollie to test out some recipe boxes and decide which is best.
Recipe boxes, are you familiar with this concept?
Yeah, I am. They're like, you get a box with a load of ingredients and instructions of what to do with them to create a meal.
Yes, exactly, right? Yeah. And is it per... because I've never done... have you done one before?
Done a HelloFresh one before.
Okay, right, yeah. Is it just you get one meal in the post delivered to your door? Is it like five or six meals? I don't even know how it works.
Well, I've had a trial one and it was literally just one meal.
Okay.
And it comes like, you know, like on Blue Peter where everything's set up and it's completely organised. It's like that, but for food.
Okay,
so
right.
So everything is there. It's all measured out. You just tip it in, stir it. Makes you look like a pro.
Okay, so you've done HelloFresh, but there's actually quite a few on the market, aren't there? I don't know if you've noticed. Every time I open a print magazine, like 10 vouchers fall out for these recipe boxes. So we are genuinely curious what you, impartially, independently, and as a vegetarian,
yep,
trying to cut down on your plastic, believe is the best recipe box on the market.
All right.
Are you prepared to accept the challenge?
Yeah, be like a better looking Jay Rayner.
You already are. See you in Slough.
See you in Slough.
Hello, Man fans. My name's Jessica Chirasi, and I'm Curator of Information and Research at the UK Government Art Collection. These are my tips on how to get the most out of a visit to an exhibition. Tip number one, read up a bit beforehand. I don't mean that you need to study, but it's a good idea to have a read of what's on the website of the museum or gallery you're going to, and perhaps a couple of reviews of the exhibition. This will give you a bit of context and let you know what to look out for as you go around the show. It means you won't spend all of your time reading, and it'll free you up to actually look at the artwork rather than read about it. Which brings me on to tip number two. Spend time looking at the works on display in detail. Doesn't mean you have to study everything meticulously, but choose maybe one work in each room that calls out to you. Try and see if you can notice anything about that work that you wouldn't get from looking at it in a photograph. Think through what the work is doing. I like to say that it's always good to spend a bit longer looking at something than is comfortable. Ask yourself, what is going on here? Tip number three, bring a friend. All of this looking and thinking and questioning about art is much easier and more enjoyable if you can team up with someone else. You may notice a lot more than you would have otherwise by thinking about it from someone else's perspective. I find I learn a lot from talking things out. Seeing an exhibition with a friend is also a lovely way to see how there isn't just one reading of a work of art, but many readings. Well, there you have it. To find out more, pick up a copy of Who's Afraid of Contemporary Art, out now, online, and in all good bookshops.
Now, what have you bought from Amazon in the past 6 months? I've just had a quick scan through my own order history, which reveals an oil-filled radiator, a cat flap, a mains adapter, some cycling gloves, a USB cable, a video rental, a smartphone case, a card game, some echinacea, and a travel guidebook. That is a far from untypically eclectic list. The range of products that Amazon delivers to your door these days is utterly bewildering, and the convenience of it can feel like a miracle of modern logistics. But all the products originate in large warehouses across the country, and all are picked and packed into boxes by human beings. Journalist James Bloodworth went undercover in 2016, travelling the country, experiencing minimum wage jobs for his new book, Hired. His first port of call was Rugeley in Staffordshire, where Amazon are the town's biggest employer. He got a job there through the temporary employment agency, Transline.
I applied through the website, kind of filled out a very basic form, and then a couple of days later I received a phone call and I was invited into to Transline's office in Cannock Chase for a interview / induction, where I turned up and there were lots of other people there who'd been invited in on the same day. We all filled out a kind of pile of forms, took a drug and alcohol test, which was slightly odd because I'd never done that for a job before, and then we were basically told that, you know, if our forms were in order, you know, we had identification, etc., we were told that we would start in a week's time.
What did they tell you the job was?
So it's order picking. They were quite vague about the job Transline was. First of all, the one point they did drum home was that it was a temporary job. One Amazon worker said, when we started, be under no illusions that this is a temporary position. And a Transline rep had said at the induction that, you know, it's a temporary position and I've got kind of 70, 80 other people waiting for the job, so if you don't want it, go away.
And I've driven past some of these Amazon warehouses. There's some near me in Hemel Hempstead. They're vast.
Yes, I mean, Amazon liked to boast that the warehouse was the size of 10 football pitches. That was a specific warehouse in Staffordshire, but I think they're all roughly similar size. The result of that was, you know, working there, you'd end up walking kind of 10, 15 miles every day because it's so 10 football pitches. I mean, that's absolutely huge, yeah.
What does it look like inside?
Sameness. It's aisle after aisle after aisle of just various items, from everything from books to kind of plant pots to grass seed to everything you can possibly imagine that's on the Amazon website is in this warehouse, just row after row of aisles. There are four floors to it as well.
And are the items arranged in any kind of logical way? I mean, are all the CDs together and all the books together or not?
There probably is some logic to it, but I can never quite work out what it was. I mean, there's a section where it's all closed, for example, but things like books are interspersed with all sorts of other things. It's not just like books and DVDs in one place. It's everything seemed to be. I couldn't work out in just under 4 weeks I was there what the logic of it was.
So what was your job, actually? Not what it was described as by the agency, but what was your typical day like?
So it would be following the directions of a handheld, like, electronic device around this huge warehouse, picking orders off the shelves, various items off the shelves, putting them in a basket. Each one would be timed by a kind of timer which would count down on the electronic device. And you'd walk around, my average was around 10 miles a day around this warehouse, just constantly picking items off the shelves, putting them in a basket, then sending the basket down a huge conveyor belt.
And I mean, you said there weren't set days, but were there set hours on the days you were working?
Yeah, so I mean, I had shifts. So I worked 4 days a week, 10.5 hours each shift. Right. But it was liable to change because we were on 0 hour contracts with the agency. It was liable to change quite quickly. So one day, I mean, I went in one day, and then the next day they said there's no work. They said there's no work tomorrow. The warehouse is closing for maintenance or something. So you immediately lose kind of one of your 10.5 hours out of your wage packet that week.
And how many days in advance were you supposed to know about the hours you'd be working?
I wasn't sure because it's 0 hours contract, the agency could effectively just tell you on that morning that there was no work. There was nothing to stop them doing that.
And are you able to say I can't work that particular Monday because I'm off doing something or not?
No. I mean, it's the flexibility. There's flexibility, but it's all one way. I mean, there wasn't much flexibility for us as order pickers, but it seemed the flexibility was in the hands of the agency.
Okay, so you turn up for work. You pick up your electronic device. I'm curious, what is it? Is it an Amazon Fire tablet that they've customised?
It's quite retrograde, in a sense. It looks quite old school, but it's it just has just this electronic device. You pick up, plug a battery into it, and it has a timer. As soon as you scan your first, it sends you around the warehouse. As soon as you scan your first item, a timer starts on it, and then it counts down, and then every time you scan another item, it replenishes the timer. So you're timed in terms of your productivity, and if your productivity falls behind the average, whatever that is at the time for that shift cohort, you will receive admonishments to speed up through the app. So you're in the bottom 10% of productivity, you need to get your productivity up. But it's typically an employee for either the agency or Amazon who's sending those things through to the device, because they're sat on a computer somewhere in the warehouse looking at who's the fastest and who's the slowest worker. It was a very lonely experience in a way, because you're in this vast warehouse. I mean, there's several hundred people in there at the time, but it's so big, you're not allowed to talk to your co-workers while you're actually working. I mean, I was told off several times for doing that. I saw other people being told off for doing that. And it's kind of quite a lonely experience for 10.5 hours, quite a long time to be just walking around, you know, on your own with your following this kind of device with your own kind of thoughts in silence.
Yeah, there's no radio.
No.
What's that about? I mean, I understand why they might not want you to go in with your own phone, but why not play something on the sound system?
I can't see any real practical reason for that. I think I didn't get the impression when I was working there that they were particularly bothered about making the work environment pleasant for workers. It seemed to be all around productivity. It was almost a version of Taylorism. So the idea that workers must be turned into perfect productive units, and anything which improves productivity is good, and anything which doesn't improve it is superfluous, if you like.
But what you're describing isn't Sports Direct. You're describing an American corporate monolith. And, okay, we know that not everyone who works for American corporate monoliths is satisfied, but we also know that the way that American corporate monoliths present themselves is about making the world better. I wondered if you saw evidence in that warehouse of that conflict between, you know, the kind of slightly dank conditions you're describing and the corporate philosophy, which was presumably all about, you know, making everyone's world more convenient and happy.
No, I mean, the corporate philosophy at Amazon, as with many contemporary companies which present this image of almost popular capitalism, you know, Richard Branson would be an example, in Britain, you know, rolled up shirt sleeves, you know, pro-diversity, uses all the correct like language, but behind that is kind of the same old, in some respects, the same attitudes towards working people. Within Amazon, there was a lot of euphemistic language used. So we weren't allowed to be called workers, we were called associates. And everyone in the company is an associate. So we were told that Jeff Bezos is an associate, and so are you as an order picker. We weren't allowed to call the place a warehouse in which we worked. It was a fulfillment center. There were cardboard cutouts of supposedly Amazon workers dotted around the warehouse, and they had speech bubbles coming from their heads. One of which said, "We love working here, we miss it when we're away."
And were you reassured as employees, you know, in the way that you said, you know, pro-diversity, doing the right thing corporately, were you assured that if there was an issue, there was someone you could speak to? Was there a sense that there was anything benign about the parent organisation?
Well, it would be Transline we mostly dealt with as an employee who dealt with things like wages, for example. And I had, zero confidence in them to deal with any issues which came up. So, for example, my first 2 weeks working there at Amazon, I was underpaid my wages. So 1 week, I think it was £50, I was underpaid by Transline. Another week, it was £60. And so effectively, I was paid below the minimum wage because we were on the minimum wage. If you knock £50 off, that takes you below it. I interviewed a young woman who lived in Cannock Chase, who worked at the Amazon for a while. And she worked for Transline, and the agency had paid her the equivalent of, I think it was 62 pence an hour. And it took her 6 weeks to claw the money back. That was because her mother threatened to report the agency to ACAS.
So they'd have said that's an administrative error, but your experience was it was happening.
But it was happening a lot, and you were given kind of short shrift by the agency if you complained about it. And essentially, the agency refused to give me a copy of my contract to start with because they said that because it was a 0 hours contract, there wasn't actually a paper document, which makes no sense at all. But they assumed I wouldn't know that. Similarly, Amazon itself, when I took a day off sick, I went back to work after I'd taken the day off sick, and someone came looking for me from Amazon and issued me with a point. It's kind of a disciplinary point because I was ill. You know, I'd phoned in beforehand to report myself ill. I said I could get a letter from the doctor if it was necessary. But this Amazon employee said, you know, this is what Amazon's always done. You receive a disciplinary point if you're off sick for a day, whether you've got a doctor's note or not.
And actually, the picture that you're painting of walking around a warehouse kind of tethered to a device, not talking to anyone, and working for a company that are distanced from your actual employer by using an agency, it's an easy thing to say, but it feels a bit Black Mirror, this.
Yeah, there was an aspect of that. And I think what was particularly, you know, harrowing about the experience was, for me, I knew I walked into the job of my own volition. I could leave, you know, when I chose. But if you think that Amazon was the biggest employer in Rugeley, every job, entry-level job there was temporary. Amazon arrived in 2011, which was exactly 20 years after the Lee Hall Colliery closed, which employed roughly a similar number of people. In the past, you'd had two power stations, which had employed a lot of people in the town. You'd had a company called Thorny MI. You'd had Armitage Shanks, which makes the sinks and toilets that most people will have in their homes. It was a kind of centre of British industry in its kind of modest way. And the biggest employers in town today were, first of all, Amazon, and then Tesco and Argos. And again, most of the entry-level jobs were temporary positions or 0 hours contracts. So it creates this kind of precarious dynamic around the town where people are struggling to get a mortgage, struggling to support a family.
That isn't Amazon's fault, is it? I mean, from their point of view, they've come in and built something where local people can work after a colliery, which was a very dangerous place to work, was closed down. That's not a bad thing.
I don't wish to romanticise the past. I mean, you could die. People did die in the colliery in Rugeley, whereas you're very unlikely to die in an Amazon warehouse. But at the same time, the colliery had a strong trade union. Similarly with the other manufacturing jobs in the area, there was kind of a support network which built up around the old industry. So social pubs, social clubs, workers' educational organisations. They were well-paid jobs as well. Coal mining in Rugeley, through the kind of victories won by the trade unions, it was by the 80s and 90s, it was a relatively well-paid job. I think a lot of people wondered in the town what regeneration really meant. So with the new jobs, companies like Amazon had come to town, and the sorts of terms and conditions they were offering were much worse than the things people were used to in the past with the old industry. So on the one hand, the newer jobs were safer than some of the things that went before them, but I felt like, and the people I communicated with in the town, that something had been lost with the old jobs, and the kind of new world of work was much more precarious, and you didn't know whether you were coming or going from one day to the next.
And who were your fellow employees?
Mostly, by the time I arrived in Rugeley, most of the people working as order pickers in Amazon were Romanians, Eastern Europeans. Local people who I interviewed said that, you know, originally when Amazon had arrived, lots of local people had worked there, but they wouldn't put up with the kind of conditions on offer. So by the time I arrived, it was mostly Eastern Europeans who were working there. I lived in a kind of bedsit with three Romanians who also worked at the company. And they would say, you know, that people like them were willing to do it because they were desperate. You'd earn £100 a week in Romania, whereas you'd earn £260, I think it was, a week in Rugeley. They were quite desperate.
What were the breaks you were permitted in your 10-hour shift?
So you had 2 15-minute breaks and 1 half-an-hour break, but you were only paid for 10 minutes of the 15-minute breaks, 10 minutes each break, and the time you had off for a break included time walking from the warehouse, going through the security gates and reaching the canteen, which could typically take as long as 10 minutes because going through security, there's a queue, you have to empty your pockets, like an airport, it's airport-style security.
And that's to stop people nicking the products, basically.
There's kind of an air of suspicion hanging over you the whole time. So we were told, you know, you're not allowed to wear hooded tops, not allowed to wear sunglasses because they need to see your eyes at all times.
And what was the canteen like?
It wasn't so bad. I mean, the one of the few good things about the place was the food was slightly subsidised. So you could get kind of a greasy plate of food for about £4 or something. One funny thing I noticed in the canteen, there was a big basket containing cough sweets and medicines and stuff. And it reminded me on my first day, someone said, you know, we need you to come in even if you're ill. You just need to self-medicate. And then there was this big pile of basket of of medicine in the canteen, which kind of, when I started off, I was relatively fit and healthy. I've been going to the gym a lot recently. I've been running quite a lot. Despite walking around 10 miles each day working at Amazon, I ended up putting on a stone in weight because the types of food I was eating while I was doing the work. Not just because the canteen tended to stock kind of greasy foods, kind of chips and mints and things like that, but because you'd end up, it was such a kind of miserable existence that you'd end up craving things that gave you that momentary kind of feeling of uplift, if you like. So I started smoking again while I was working there because you just feel depressed and you want something that gives you that momentary kick, if you like, whether it's a Mars bar, whether it's a big plate of greasy food and a kebab, or whether it's kind of a cigarette and beers after work. You just fall into that lifestyle when you're doing a job that you derive no pleasure from.
Did your fellow employees express surprise that you were British?
Yes. I mean, on one of my first days, a young woman from Romania came up to me and was kind of incredulous that I was working there. So she said, you know, why are you working here? You're British. And she said something strange, which was, you don't have a picker's face, an order picker's face, which, I mean, I didn't really, that kind of confused me what that meant. But I think it was a kind of class thing. I looked too healthy. I looked too middle class to be working in a place like that. But it was acceptable for other people, notably Romanians or Eastern Europeans. It was okay for them to be treated like that, but for other people it wasn't.
Did you see people dismissed because they weren't productive enough?
I was warned that I was in the my first week working at Amazon, I was in the bottom 10% of, I was told I was in the bottom 10% in terms of productivity, and I was told if I didn't get my productivity up, I'd receive a disciplinary point, which, again, if I received 6 of those, I would effectively lose my job.
And how fast were you working?
Pretty fast, I thought.
That to me. I mean, how many orders are you picking up and putting into boxes?
In an hour, it would be about 90 orders an hour. And I'd be running around this warehouse.
Running?
You were told you can't run, but the only way to satisfy the productivity criteria would be to run. Again, it's one of those things, there were rules that you couldn't not break if you wanted to keep your job.
Was there anyone there who enjoyed their job?
I didn't meet anyone who enjoyed their job, truthfully. No, I mean, even the Eastern Europeans who we were often told, you know, like hard work, they would complain and swear about the managers and about the job, and were constantly looking for other things, other jobs that were less grim.
What seemed to be the most popular products people were ordering?
Books and DVDs probably would be the thing I found myself picking as an order picker most. I don't think I ever picked the same item twice because there were so many, millions and millions of products in this warehouse that I never ended up picking the same product twice.
Never?
No, I don't think I ever did, no.
So even a big selling, I don't know, Harry Potter book or Adele CD?
No, the warehouses contain so many items.
Was there any level of sort of entertainment in that to divert your own attention from the drudgery of it? To think, oh, this is a thing, I didn't realise you get padlocks in the shape of a Swiss Army knife or whatever it might be.
You end up, the longer you work there, creating a sense of mischief almost, because there is this air of almost menace hanging over you from the management that you feel like you can't do good anyway. It's almost like you're under a cloud of suspicion the whole time, almost as when you're at school that can happen, but you haven't done anything wrong, so you feel this powerful sense of injustice, so that you start to behave worse. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you see, kind of, I remember I saw crisp packets on the floor, and whereas in another context, I might have picked them up and put them in the litter bin. I just leave them. Or you'll deliver a kind of satisfying boot to the spine of some DVDs as you walk past, because it's just a case of, well, you know, screw these guys. They don't give a damn about us, so why should we care about their business?
And when you were paid properly, you know, as in the minimum wage for the hours that you'd worked, what did that leave you to spend your money on in a place like Ridgely once you'd paid your rent?
Well, what I found was you can keep your head above water on the minimum wage, provided there are no emergencies. So I could afford, my rent was, I think, around £90 a week for a room in kind of a bedsit, with that included all the bills. I had enough with that to kind of eat and have, you know, a couple of beers a week and buy one pack of cigarettes a week or something. But it's if there's an emergency. So let's say, you know, you need to go to the dentist or something, or I know you need to buy a new pair of shoes because they're getting a hole in because you're walking 10 miles every day, then you there's a big hole in your budget, then you end up going to like borrowing money off family, or if you don't have family, that's, you can see quite easily how people get into debt with kind of payday loans and things like that, because you have a sudden hole in your budget. Or if the company suddenly tells you that there's no work the next day because you're on a 0-hour contract, you suddenly find that there's a great gaping hole in your budget that week.
Did you change your mind about this kind of working environment? Because, you know, you are politically left. You went into this writing a book thinking, I'm going to expose what it's like working for the minimum wage, and presumably didn't think it would be a great experience. Did you change your mind about it?
Yes, I'm politically left. You know, a decade before I wrote the book, I'd worked in warehouses. I'd worked on building sites. I'd worked in kind of shops, bars. I'd done all those kind of jobs before, but I was genuinely shocked by some of the things I saw, not just in the Amazon warehouse, but in some of the other jobs I did. It felt like there had been a real deterioration compared to, say, 10 years before and further back, in terms of terms and conditions that workers were having to put up with, kind of the other side of the recession, the 2008 recession, if you like. It felt like people were really suffering in a way that I hadn't quite understood so well before from my journalism job in London.
Do you think that's part of the problem, that the laws are made in London too, and most of the media are based in London, or if not Manchester or Birmingham, cities where the kind of class of people that write the laws and write the newspapers that report on the laws don't experience what you have?
I think it's partly regional. So, I mean, there is, if you visit towns like Rugeley, if you visit some of the towns in South Wales particularly, like Ebervale and Coombe, it really kind of smacks you in the face, some of the deprivation and some of the kind of social consequences of the lack of work. But I mean, in some ways, our society today it's easier to shelter yourself from the kind of the hardship that makes the wheels turn, if you like. It's easy to kind of wall yourself off from it. Amazon would be a good example, because if you're ordering from the Amazon website, you don't necessarily ever have to see or even think about what goes on in somewhere in a warehouse that's kind of sorting your goods. You don't really ever, you can wall yourself off from it. In some ways, it's comparable to how our ancestors a century ago could kind of wall themselves off from what went on in the pink splodges on the map where the empire was, and where there were kind of a class of people who were giving us some of our prosperity, giving us kind of the lifestyles that we kind of enjoyed, and we didn't have to see how they actually sweated to bring that about.
I mean, obviously, the conditions you're describing could be improved fairly straightforwardly. I mean, you know, as you say, just a concession to think how workers might be feeling, you know, wouldn't necessarily cost anything at all, apart from possibly one person's job to focus on that. So that's something that could change. But at the end of the day, working in a factory or working in a distribution warehouse is always going to be a low-paid job. It isn't going to be something that's aspirational. What can Amazon do to improve things?
No one is saying that you shouldn't expect to do some kind of hard work, like least of all me. But it's just the sense of unfairness to things like being disciplined for taking a day off sick, whether you have a note from the doctors or not. I think most people that would seem wrong. It flies in the face of what we think of as a kind of civilized country, using agencies which again don't always pay the minimum wage. This obsession around productivity, where it's clearly making workers in these depots really miserable, and you have towns where, like Rugeley, where there is a proud history of working hard. I mean, those people who went down the coal mine, they were no slouches. You know, this is a place where people haven't been afraid of hard work. But as one former collier in the town said to me, he wouldn't work at Amazon because of the way they speak to you. It's about dignity and self-respect.
Well, do you think that's something that might happen? Because actually, that is something that can change.
I'm not particularly hopeful. I think rather than relying on Amazon to turn into this benevolent company, I think the battle is empowering people who work in those places to actually organise and change things for themselves.
And possibly telling consumers not to shop there.
I think part of the battle is getting people that can afford to shop ethically to do so. I mean, I wouldn't want to lecture people who are struggling that they need to kind of spend more money on things that make life slightly more enjoyable. But I think that people who can afford to shop ethically, the same with things like fair trade, it's fair to ask them to take a second look at the supply chain where they're buying things from.
Okay, I mean, I've got an awkward confession for you, which is I've been reading your book. I did buy it on Amazon.
Before?
Before the interview, before I read it, but I unthinkingly bought it on Amazon. I thought, oh, I'm going to meet James. Oh, I should read his book. And it was one click on my smartphone away. Where are you telling people to buy your book?
So now I tell people to buy the book elsewhere. So Waterstones, I'd point someone in the direction of.
So they've got a website. And
yeah,
they send it out just the same.
Yeah, I mean, you can buy it from Waterstones.
And it's a few quid more.
WH Smiths. No, it's the same price.
It
should be the same price, yeah.
It's just the convenience then, really, that's stopping me from doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it's
also the habit, I think.
Yes.
So, I mean, look, I think it's a mistake to think that we have to be perfect or we have to have been perfect in the past on these things. I mean, I've bought things from Amazon in the past. I've used Uber taxis in the past. But it's also about learning about these things, then pushing for kind of legislative change so that we can tighten laws up to make sure things like minimum wage are enforced. And also, yeah, empowering the people who work in there, not just thinking we can solve the problem with consumer boycotts, because I don't think we can. I think it will take more than that.
Does it amuse you to think that somewhere in the corner of that warehouse are lots of copies of your book?
It's slightly depressing, but then again, I think it's not my fault that Amazon now it controls almost, you know, a big proportion of the distribution of books. I mean, I find that quite problematic as well. I wish that wasn't the case, but it is. You can't opt out of the system. You know, you can go and live completely ethically in a tent in the woods or something, but it's not really feasible. So, I mean, yeah, we have to live with what we've got and try to change the system from within.
James Bloodworth. And if you enjoyed that, I'd really recommend his book, Hired. We just talked about Amazon in this interview, but in the book, he also experiences working in the gig economy for Uber and as a carer for elderly people in Blackpool. It is a great read. I genuinely recommend it. And on our website, I've linked to the Waterstones page where you can buy the book, although it is, in actual fact, 75p more expensive than via Amazon. Still to come, our record of the week. And Alex Fox is up next after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Come on down. The fox is often right. It's time for the foxhole. Alex Fox is here. Hello, Alex.
Hey there, Ollie. I hope you're feeling so joyous today that it's as though you ate a big bowl of amuesli for breakfast.
What have you been up to this week?
I've been chatting to a woman named Gina Martin, who is campaigning for change in the law. A few summers ago, Gina was at a festival with her sister, enjoying the music, hanging out in the crowd, having a good time. The sun was blazing and she was wearing a skirt. She happened to spy a group of men just ahead of her who were looking at something on a mobile phone, and she caught sight over one of their shoulders of a picture that had been taken by holding the mobile handset under her skirt.
No.
And taking a snap of her knickers.
Oh.
So she grabbed their phone and took it to a security guy and kind of made a fuss and said, "This is unacceptable. I'm just here trying to live my life and enjoy this lovely day with my sister. And these guys are harassing people by taking pictures up their skirts." The matter was escalated to the police, and I'm really glad that the festival staff, from what I can tell, took it really seriously. But she was told that nothing really could be done because it is not against the law currently to take a picture of someone's underwear, upskirting as it's called,
is not a crime. And so Gina is now campaigning to make that against the law. She started a Twitter campaign, which is hashtag stop skirting the issue, to give women, or indeed anybody who feels that inappropriately sexual pictures have been taken of them and maybe circulated, some support, something that they can fall back on.
I can't imagine how that's not against the law. I mean, just not that this is a male-female issue, but obviously I, you know, don't have a vagina, so imagining this from a male perspective. If I was wearing a pair of shorts, someone stuck a camera on the floor and took a picture of my dangly balls and then posted it online, I would imagine that was a crime. It just seems absolutely obvious that that's a violation.
It feels criminal. I asked Gina about this because it occurred to me that a lot of the paparazzi shots you see of celebrities in short dresses getting out of cabs or getting out of limousines at big star-studded red carpet events, a lot of photographers make it their mission
to try
and get that upskirt shot of someone's thong. As with all law, it would need to be interpreted in a sensible fashion. So if you were examining something like paparazzi shots and there was a genuinely accidental picture of someone's underwear, whoever was assessing this legally would take into account, well, how many pictures were there in that camera roll? What's the angle? Does it look like this person was intentionally trying to take a shot that exposed something that this person really wanted to keep private and to themselves? So that there will be room for interpretation if the law gets changed. But if that law exists, it means that people who feel that they have been violated, who are traumatised potentially by that, who might have been massively publicly embarrassed by it, they have some official support there.
Time for our listener question, as ever sponsored by our friends at mycondom.com. Remind us, Alex, of their excellent service.
Well, they sell all sorts of hard-to-get-your-hands-on condoms and lubes and sex toys, a massive range at really, really great prices. But they also have a fascinating blog. Mm-hmm. And recently, they were chatting about the research of a gent called Dr. Daniel Fenton. He works as medical director at the London Doctors Clinic. And he's warning people that beards, which are very popular at the moment, shout out, Ollie P, can actually be a hotbed for STIs like the herpes type 1 virus, HSV1, and they can play host to pubic lice.
But presumably only if you're going down on someone, right? That's how they...
That's the thing. Yeah. He's trying to alert people that if you are a carrier of an STI, then your beard may be a way of passing it on.
What a resource. This week's question is from Adam in Western Australia, who says, Alex, my partner the other day in passing said she wished there was such a thing as a silent vibrator for some stealth foolery. Is there?
Well, I really, really wish there was, because there are so many companies that make vibrators that they claim are almost silent or whisper quiet, and they're freaking loud. Put it this way, you would get chucked out of a library if you tried to use them in amid the reference books.
Mm. Is that because of the technical challenges involved in making a buzzy thing not vibrate?
The problem is, if you've got anything that's got a power source, be that plugging it into the mains or using USB rechargeable power or putting batteries in it, it's going to have motors inside it, either to make it vibrate or to create pulses of air or make it move in some way. Mm. That motion is going to cause some form of sound. And particularly if you're someone who requires fairly powerful stimulation, it tends to be the case that the greater the power, the greater the volume. In short, it's actually quite difficult to make an effective vibrator and still make it really, really silent. My personal favourite toys are pretty loud. I have a few workarounds for that. For a start, I wait until my flatmate is out of the house before indulging in my most booming battery-operated boyfriends. But if you use something under a thick duvet, then that can help mask some of the sounds. I also use an app called Noisly, N-O-I-S-L-I, which is a white noise generator. It's really good. It's got all sorts of different types of white noise, so you can have The sound of thunderstorms, which I find quite sexy anyway, or you can have tweeting birds, or you can have
tweeting birds in your bedroom so that your flatmate doesn't know that you're treating yourself, isn't he just
every time the birds go off he knows that I'm fertling with my birdie parts.
Exactly.
So, well, I actually also use the app for concentration. I find that I have a mix of kind of the sounds of people in a coffee shop and a chugging train really helps me to concentrate.
Okay, so those are some workarounds, but back to my question, if you do just want the quietest vibrator you can get, do you have a recommendation?
I have a few, because different things work for different people. So I ask my sex toy reviewer friends. Kara Sutra of KaraSutra.com said that the Loving Joy Power Bullet Vibrator is surprisingly quiet and still gives her a guaranteed orgasm. Mm-hmm. But she does say if you need something with a bit more power, like a wand vibrator, the O Wand is surprisingly quiet. And Violet Fenn, again, another brilliant sex toy reviewer, she backs up Kara and she says the Mini Magic Wand from Love Honey absolutely passed her Can I Wank Without the Kids in the Next Bedroom Hearing Me test, which is a rarity in itself. And the guy behind Sloob, which is a product we've mentioned before, you know, that you make the vats of erotic slime.
Yeah, like Slimer from Ghostbusters.
Yes, exactly. Dan said that there is a toy that was specifically made to be super quiet called Shy Play. He doesn't know whether they make it anymore, though, which is odd, because I would have thought that the demand for a genuinely good quiet vibrator was, it must be really, really high.
And so whilst the hunt for the perfectly silent vibrator continues, what else can people do in the meantime?
They can buy a perfectly silent sex toy which doesn't vibrate, commonly known as a dildo.
Yeah.
People often...
You're holding something that doesn't look like a dildo. It looks like a thermos.
Yeah, I was going to say it. Well, I'm going to try...
What is that?
This is a new form of dildo and it has special moves. It's got very unique qualities to it, and I thought I would get you to guess what those are.
Okay.
Ollie, this is new from a German company, I think they're German, called Dodil.
I see what they've done.
They're mixing up the dildo.
It's a new take on a dildo.
So,
and it literally looks like a thermos.
You're
at the
right. It's contained within this sort of stubby, wide-necked thermos.
Yeah,
right?
And you're opening it, and yes, there is something that appears to be a sort of cockhead shaped thing inside.
Yeah, it's sort of like a large pill-shaped, teal-coloured rod. Well, there's a third part.
Ooh!
There is this orange sort of plastic
looks like fishing rod
twine.
Wire.
I think it looks like what you put in a strimmer. Can you guess, Ollie, how these three items combine in order to make this plaything particularly innovative?
Okay, so then we've got the rubberized tube, we've got the orange plastic twine, and the thermos.
You're actually not too far off the truth by referring to it as a thermos. What would you do with a thermos?
Fill it with nice hot cider and take it out fishing.
What happens is you fill it with hot liquid.
Yeah.
You put the
dildo
inside. Yeah, you put the rod inside.
Right, and then imagine it's floating, right?
You pop the lid on.
Yeah.
It heats up. And when it becomes hot, it gets malleable.
Right.
So you can squidge it into different shapes. You wrap the twine around
so
it if you want to make
shapes.
Like ribs or corkscrews. Yeah, yeah. And then if you come up with a shape that you like, then you leave it to cool and it sets hard. And you can repeat and reheat and change it up as many times as you want.
That's quite nice, because every time you use it, you're effectively cleaning it by putting it in hot water as well.
Yeah, you're disinfecting it.
Yeah.
And what I also like about it, it's really playful. It's a thing that you could do together with your partner, which would start interesting conversations. It's, you know, it's a bit silly, it's relaxing. I'm always saying in the Foxhole how there's so much pressure for sex to be super serious and performative and sultry and sensual, and sometimes, especially if people have had a long day or they're stressed, or you know, it's difficult to go into that mind frame, and it can end up making sexual experiences feel like an additional thing to worry about. Whereas doing something that is a little bit silly and kind of almost like crafty, you know, it's like a little bit of cross stitch, maybe a bit of basket weaving, and then mold a dildo.
Alex, as ever, thank you for that. If you have a question that she can help with in next week's edition, what do you need to do with it?
Head on over to modernmanwith2ns.co.uk and hit feedback. You don't have to give your name if you don't want to.
And remember, if you want to keep yourself amused in the bedroom, then you can find all the accessories that you could ever possibly want at mycondom.com.
And if you use the code FOXHOLE, FOXHOLE, you get 15% off everything.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this week's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new man ambassador. It's David in Adelaide who says, "Ollie, my wife and I listen to your show every weekend on our way to the nudist beach. All your interesting features make for perfect in-car listening, well worth the beer money I've just signed up for. I'm not sure if you have a nudist manbassador yet, but I'd be proud to fill that role for you." David, frankly, I'm not sure if we do either. No one's ever mentioned that predilection before. But now, if we ever have a manbassador meetup, I'm sure you would make a memorable addition to the lineup. I now pronounce you manbassador for Adelaide. Congratulations. Music now, and our theme is by Django Django, who are on tour now. Go see them. And what in the heck is this? Why, it's our new record of the week by Carpenter Brut. It's called Beware the Beast, and it's available to stream now. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you in Slough.
We kiss shadows with the shape of our snow. Delicious bones to rest the unknown. A dull ache from the hunger of flesh. Wild veins beneath the surface. Drunk rush as our bodies crash. Then you put your hands around my neck. Pumping up in a sea of blood. Tongues licking at the devil's nightmare. Beware of the beast inside your soul.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.